Ortega continues to be an example of construction and social progress in Latin America. Today, it has 104 large hospitals, 143 health centers, free education, free health, national independence, and also, why not say it, at the international level, today it is on the right side of history. That is, entering unity and in alliance with those who are seeking a multipolar world, such as Russia, China, Iran, and other countries.
Como el caso, Rusia, China, Irán, y otros países.
Nicaragua today is on its feet. This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes.
I am with Gadiel Archi. He has a bachelor's degree and is ambassador of Nicaragua in Chile. He used to be a student leader. At the same time, he was a convicted revolutionary who fought on the Sandinista front in very difficult moments. He has also some internationalist missions. You're very welcome, Gadiel, to our program, Black and White.
Thank you very much, Eduardo. It's a great honor for me to be on this show, precisely when we are on a day of the 128th anniversary of the birth of the great General Sandino.
Please explain to us a little about the importance of General Sandino. His stature spans all of Latin America and even worldwide, even though he was a small man. But he had a tremendous heart that was the general of free men. That's how he was known. Tell us a little about him and what this anniversary means.
Sandino, como usted sabe, compañero Eduardo.
As you know, and the world will know, Sandino defeated the U.S. Marines. Nicaragua has been a country that has experienced constant wars, and Sandino rebels against the United States and wages a six-year war. The United States intervened and occupied Nicaragua. Sandino expels and defeats the U.S., and it is the first defeat that the United States had in Latin America. In the Pentagon, until recently, they had two flags of their defeats on the left and their victories on the right. Between their two defeats, there are Vietnam and Nicaragua. Sandino is a world icon for fighting for the national sovereignty of Nicaragua. It is a great inheritance that we currently have. It is interesting that Albert Einstein says about Sandino, "You are a universal general." Gabriel Mistral, the Chilean Nobel Prize winner, says, "The little crazy army." And the French intellectual says, "The general of free men." And coincidentally, we're happy because this legacy, this flag, we continue to hold high today.
How can we approach this legacy today? General Sandino's proposal for sovereignty, social justice, national independence, and the construction of a good society.
In July 19, 1979, a group of guerrillas led by Commander Daniel Ortega entered Managua victorious, following the legacy of Sandino. Currently, what is this legacy of Sandino? National sovereignty. We are a country that raises this flag of national sovereignty. In the new world architecture, in this new world composition, where the United States insists on maintaining the Monroe Doctrine, the doctrine of manifest destiny, the new configuration is this legacy of Sandino to have relations with all the countries of the world within the framework of respect for our national sovereignty.
A nuestra soberanía nacional. Interesante. Ahora, dime.
It is really interesting. Now, how can you understand this pause that exists between the first moment of the Sandinista government after the triumph and its resumption? And this pause that was to some extent determined by the fall of the countries in the socialist orbit at the time. How is it reconstructed? Because it is very new that they had the ability to retake the government with an overwhelming majority, according to the figures.
We see it from this point of view. The first stage, the fight of Sandinista Front, has been long since Sandino. Then the fight in the mountains, which was very difficult, but we managed to win on July 19. We had 10 years with the construction of the first stage of the revolution, besieged by the U.S. We were just beginning to govern, and the government of the President Reagan began with a hostile policy and with a war of aggression, that even this war of aggression, we sued in the International Court of Justice, and we won it. Nicaragua won this dispute that we raised. So these 10 years of building the new Nicaragua where the U.S. ambassador was no longer in charge, where the Pentagon was no longer in charge. To say, vote in the United Nations like this, vote in international forums in this way. July 19 for us meant the independence and total sovereignty of Nicaragua. What happened? Let's say that in these 10 years, there has been enormous wear and tear. Nicaraguan society lived in war, this war of aggression. Commander Daniel Ortega made the decision to hold the elections even at war, because no one holds elections at war, and we lost it. We say that the people did not vote against the Sandinista Front. The people voted for peace, because there was social wear. However, later, there were 16 years of neoliberal governments. In these 16 years, the country totally regressed, and at the level of foreign policy, it returned to the U.S. dominance, at the level of social demands, at the level of the achievements that we had achieved. They were completely moved backwards. After these 16 years, there was no electricity for 14 hours in Nicaragua.
Perfect. We will continue our talk after a break, and we will follow this question. Why was it possible to resume the Sandinista government?
Thank you very much, for sure.
I continue my talk with Gadiel Arce in this interesting interview about Nicaragua. We were talking about the moment when the plebiscite took place and the Sandinista Front lost it, and that it is explaining very well that rather than losing it, what the people voted for was peace, because Nicaragua was living a moment of very strong struggle and with material implications of consequences of the intervention of North American imperialism and the government of Ronald Reagan. Please.
Perfect. One piece of information is important. Many times the Sandinista Front is laid to be anti-democratic, and there is a series of lies from the empire that we already know. Referring to the democratic character of the Sandinista Front, when taking power by force of arms, handing it over by way of elections, later there were three periods, 1, 2, 3. Until in 2006, we retook power, we won the government. It is very important to mention that the Sandinista Front has always had the power because there was this relation with the nation, humble people, students, workers and peasants, and we will never stop this.
That's why we're talking about a real revolution, because if we do not lose contact with people, there is no problem. Everything can be recovered.
Commander Daniel Ortega said a very interesting phrase in the 1990s. We are going to govern from the base. Because one thing is to govern, and another thing is to have power. So the power is in the hands of the people. Even our slogan now is that the people preside. So these periods of neoliberalism passed, where health, education, housing, and electric light went backwards. We had a 14-hour blackout in Nicaragua, where the electrical matrix completely collapsed. In 2007, the people voted in favor of us precisely because we were three in the streets. Commander Daniel visited farmers and university students and went throughout the national territory, expanding the Sandinista Front, and he didn't step back. He was present in the worst moments. That's why the people voted in favor of us in 2007, and we started the second period of the revolution.
Etapa de la revolución.
segunda etapa que también no es...
It was not actually a simple stage. In 2008, there is an incredible coup attempt with a terrorist act. Tell us a little about this and how you see the measures that the government of Commander Daniel Ortega had to take in defense of sovereignty, independence, and the established order within Nicaragua.
Okay, perfecto, hermano. ¿Qué pasa, por ejemplo,
en well, what really happens in the second period of government? We built a new model of governing the country. It is a model that includes the government, the workers, and the businessmen. This model is with the origin of idiosyncrasy. It allows us to agree on these three actors in the governance of the country. The result is spectacular in the first years. We grew by almost 5%, and the country begins a path of peace that we have never had in history. Nicaragua begins with roads, health centers, universities in the countryside. It is no longer the illiterate Nicaragua, but rather a developing Nicaragua. Apparently, North Americans, the North American Empire, the European Empire, didn't like this model of governance, because indeed we were building the new Nicaragua that was benefiting the poor of Nicaragua. What happened next? The United States gives the order to the business community that was building the new homeland with us to get out of this model. The United States also gives the order to a small group of students and starts to play them. They begin to build a group of mercenaries in Nicaragua. Later in 2018, the role they give to these political movements is to create thousands of false NGOs, NGOs that were completely invented to finance this failed coup. In 2018, they were advancing with a matrix of lies, because this is very important to say, the matrix of lies that they were building at the level of social media. In 2018, they attempted a coup, deceiving certain sectors of our society. They rose up, and we, led by Commander Daniel Ortega and Mrs. Rosario, managed to defeat them. I have to be clear that we defeated the U.S. policy. Why? Because the U.S. was paying the individuals and financing the groups, and we have all the sources, all the data on the internet and how USAID paid these mercenaries. Nicaragua, like other countries, for example, Chile, takes care of its institutionality. The Latin American countries and the U.S. also take care of their institutionality. So we have laws. What we have done is simply apply our laws to these groups, and we were violating our laws. But in addition, the violation of our laws was due to the murder of Nicaraguan people. Dead policemen, murdered policemen lying on the streets. They were set on fire in the streets. These cops were burned alive. This was a policy of terror in this century. We were successful in defeating this policy of terror and with people's participation, which is the element that constructs the revolution.
Querido compañero.
Perfecto. Sí.
Perfect. But in particular, the nationality was taken away.
La nacionalidad.
Claro que sí.
Yes, that's right. The U.S. applies death penalty and kills those traitors who violate their sovereignty. In Chile, there are also certain laws. All countries have their own laws against the ones who want to destroy the peace of the people and society, the peace that is difficult to build. We simply applied the laws of a constitutional government that is our government to those traitors. There's a sum of factors for receiving money from abroad, for murdering the people of Nicaragua, and for obeying the mandates of a foreign policy. We have this kind of treatment from Sandino. Sandino was implacable with the traitors because there is no other way. One can have different opinions about political issues at the internal level, but we can discuss these differences among Nicaraguan people. But what was the history? Because the information is very important. The U.S. has wanted to have Nicaragua as a colony. Imagine, Eduardo, that the U.S. put an American president in our country in 1856, William Walker. William Walker had two main decrees. There were slavery and the English language officially. In this small country, the U.S. created all the war laboratories they tested with the Nicaraguans, but Sandio rises up. And pay attention that there are loyal people like Commander Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo and an army of young people who stand up and say, no, here we Nicaraguans rule, and we set our laws and constitution, and we apply them to those people who threaten our peace and stability as a country.
Well, thank you, Gidiel. We have just a few minutes to end our program. The ties with Latin America, mainly because there are apparently progressive governments that have not been good with the sovereign government of Nicaragua. However, other governments are. How is this situation at the Latin American level? In a few seconds, please.
For sure, we maintain a global harmony policy of respect for international law, and this is what we demand from other countries. We respect them, and they have to do the same. And we are involved in this new world architecture in favor of peace and the development of nations. Well, dear friend, I want to thank you for this little interview.
Muchas gracias, Gabriel.
Thank you very much, Gadiel. We hope the best for Nicaragua in this episode of Black and White. It's a sign of friendship. Long live peace.
Encantado, Gabriel.
Viva la paz.
Eso es.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions, Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the Limelight.
Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley has suggested that Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell should step down after an episode where the senator physically froze and was unable to speak at the Capitol this week. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Britain's Guardian newspaper has covered this story and tells us more. Presidential hopeful Nikki Haley has suggested her fellow Republican Mitch McConnell, the longtime powerful US Senate leader, should step aside after an episode in which he physically froze and was unable to speak at the Capitol this week. Appearing on CBS's Face the Nation program on Sunday, Nikki Haley was asked by the host Margaret Brennan whether she still had confidence in Mitch McConnell's ability to lead after the episode. Nikki Haley said, "I think Mitch McConnell did an amazing job when it comes to our judiciary. When we look at the judges, when we look at the Supreme Court, he's been a great leader." The former South Carolina governor and former United Nations ambassador in Donald Trump's presidency, Nikki Haley added, "But we've got to stop electing people because they look good in a picture and they hold a baby well." She also said the 90-year-old U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein, the 80-year-old President Joe Biden, and 83-year-old Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi, all of whom are prominent Democrats, should know when to walk away. Nikki Haley has called for congressional term limits and mental acuity tests for politicians aged 75 and above. A spokesperson for Mitch McConnell, an 81-year-old, said last week that he intends to fulfill his term in office, which ends in 2026. Mitch McConnell has led the U.S. Senate's Republican Conference since 2007. McConnell's office said the senator felt lightheaded but has not released more details on what caused the episode in question. Mitch McConnell was hospitalized after he fell on stage earlier this year, leaving him with a concussion and a fractured rib. He also fell in Finland earlier this year while getting off an airplane at Reagan National Airport in Washington, D.C. Mitch McConnell survived polio as a child, though the illness has long affected his gait. Publicly, Senate Republicans have backed McConnell, yet anonymously, some have been more circumspect. One Republican senator told NBC News that McConnell has been relying more on his lieutenants and suggested he should step down. "I'd hate to see it forced on him," the senator said, according to NBC. "You can do these things with dignity, or it becomes less dignified, and I hope he does it in a dignified way for his own legacy and reputation." The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story and tells us more. Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley suggested the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell should step down amid the senior senator's health concerns. Mitch McConnell froze at a leadership press briefing for almost 20 seconds on last Wednesday, prompting concerns both at the briefing from his colleagues and members of the press corps and for the ensuing days. Later in the week, the senator said he was fine and that he would serve out his full term in office, but even as he tried to brush aside concerns from his colleagues, many are wondering whether he will step away from his leadership position. Nikki Haley, in an interview with CBS News' Margaret Brennan, said Mitch McConnell should know when to walk away, but took it a step further, renewing her calls for term limits. "What I'm saying about Mitch McConnell, Dianne Feinstein, Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, all of them, know when to walk away. We have huge issues that need new solutions," Haley said. Nikki Haley praised Mitch McConnell's work on the Supreme Court and other judicial confirmations before calling for a new generation of leaders. "We've got to stop electing people because they look good in the picture or they hold a baby well. We've got to stop electing people because we like them and they've been there for a long time. You need to have term limits because we need new ideas, we need new solutions." Haley added, "We've got to have a new generation." Nikki Haley, when asked if Donald Trump should also take a competency test, said everyone should take it, and the need for new leaders applies to the former president and current Republican frontrunner. Republicans have lost the last 7 out of 8 popular votes for president, Nikki Haley said. "That's nothing to be proud of. We should want to win the majority of Americans. We've got to start going with a new generation so that we can do that." The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. Nikki Haley is once again pressing Washington's graying political establishment to step aside after a pair of concerning moments involving two of the Senate's oldest members grabbed headlines in recent days. The former South Carolina governor and former United Nations ambassador spoke to CBS's Margaret Brennan in an interview that aired on Sunday. She is currently campaigning in early primary states as she seeks the GOP nomination for president. A central tenet of her campaign's message since its onset has been a call for a new generation of leaders to take the helm in both political parties. As such, Margaret Brennan asked Nikki Haley about the moment that Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell froze and appeared unable to speak at a press conference last Wednesday, after which he was led away by a colleague. It was later revealed that the Senate GOP leader had suffered an undisclosed fall earlier in July while still recovering from a concussion suffered last spring. I think Mitch McConnell did an amazing job when it comes to our judiciary. When we look at the judges, when we look at the Supreme Court, he's been a great leader. But I do think that this one, you know, we've got to stop electing people because they look good in the picture or they hold a baby well. Nikki Haley added, we've got to stop electing people because we like them and they've been there for a long time. That's actually the problem. We need to have term limits because we need new ideas and new solutions. We've got to have a new generation. Nikki Haley added, when pressed by Margaret Brennan on whether she had confidence in Mitch McConnell remaining leader of the Senate Republican caucus. What I'm saying about Mitch McConnell, Dianne Feinstein, Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, all of them, know when to walk away. Know when to walk away. We have huge issues that need new solutions. We need new generational leaders. We appreciate your service. We appreciate what you have done. But this is why we will fight for term limits. We've got to get it done in America. Nikki Haley's remark naming Senator Feinstein was an apparent reference to another moment that drew the attention of reporters this past week when the senior senator from California appeared confused during a committee hearing and launched into a speech calling for a vote which was already in progress. And persistent concerns about Joe Biden's age have followed him doggedly throughout his first term in office. The 80-year-old Joe Biden was already the oldest U.S. president to be sworn into office in 2021 and is now facing some calls from progressives and others concerned about his criticisms focused on his mental acuity to step aside and allow a younger politician to be the Democratic Party's standard bearer. Nancy Pelosi's inclusion on the list is the only notable, given that she is the sole named party leader to have already given up her leadership position willingly earlier this year. The 83-year-old California Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi handed over command of the Democratic caucus to Hakeem Jeffries at the beginning of the year, while Republicans struggled to anoint their own leader in a chaotic speakership election. Nikki Haley was less certain in an interview with CBS whether Donald Trump, 77 years old, would be included in her call for aging politicians to step aside. But she maintained that he should take a mental acuity test, as she argues all presidential contenders should. And she relented after pressing from Margaret Brennan that Donald Trump was, of course, not who she had in mind when she made her call for leaders with new ideas, age notwithstanding. I just said we need a new generational leader, she noted. I mean, that goes for all of them. You can look across Washington, D.C. Of course, I'm talking about Donald Trump. I've said that throughout this campaign that this is time for us to have a new generation.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers, sisters, listeners. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program, Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. One of the keys of life, one of the keys of success of life is being good to your parents, your mother and your father. Yes, it is actually the key of success in this world and in the hereafter. If the parents are not taken care of, then we will lose in this world and in the hereafter. As simple as that. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when it comes to the parents, He kind of He doesn't take a joke. He's very serious about it. Allah and be nice to your parents. That's the ayat. Four times in the Quran mentioned that Allah first, then your parents. No joking around, no playing around. It's a red line. Allah goes to say, even if your parents are bad, صاحبهم في الدنيا معروفة, be nice to them. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, even in jahadaka, if they rage a war against you, لِتُشْرِكَ بِي, so you could commit a shirk and take partners to me. He said, فَلَا تَطُحْهُمَا. All right, obviously, don't obey them in that. But, وَعَاشِرُهُمَا. You have to be nice to them, though. The way you talk, the way you deal with them, has to be done in the appropriate manner. So you need to keep that in mind. Now, we want to look at the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam in this regard. When it comes to the effects that we will gain when it comes to being nice and kind to our parents, one of which is the rida of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the pleasure of Allah. You be nice to your parents, Allah will be pleased with you. Nuzul al-Rahmati min as-sama, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will send His mercy from the heavens upon you if you are nice to your parents. And three, al-fawz bi-a'la gharaf al-jannah, Allah will give you the best of places in heaven just for being to your parents. A hadith from Imam al-Baqir alayhi as-salam, he says, أربع من كن فيه من المؤمنين أسكنه الله في أعلى عليين. Four things, if they are present in a mu'min, they exist in a mu'min, then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give him a residency in the highest place amongst the عليين themselves, those who are of high status. في غرف فوق غرف, rooms upon rooms. في محل الشرف كل الشرف, in a place of honor, which is all the honor. I mean, obviously, we have to go to heaven, inshallah, to understand these concepts. And then he says, من أنفق على والدي, one, he spends on his parents. ورفق بهما, he takes care of them, and he's gentle with them. وبرهما ولم يحزنهما, and he's kindly, always gentle and kind with them, and he never makes them upset. If a person has these qualities with his parents, the Imam says that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give him the highest place in heaven. So you have to keep in mind that success in the afterlife depends on that. If we don't do these four things, then obviously we will not succeed in the afterlife. So you have to be very careful when it comes to the parents. It's a red line that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not take lightly. As much as there are benefits and effects to being good to the parents, there are negatives to being bad to the parents. So if being good means I will go to heaven, being bad means I'm going to go to hell. It doesn't matter how good you are. It doesn't matter how much you pray. It doesn't matter how much you fast. If you are bad, disobedient to your parents, you make them upset and sad, then you can simply forget about seeing heaven. Let's take a short break and then we will begin.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafati, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. One of the effects that we will have on Day of Judgment once we go to heaven is on Day of Judgment itself, it's a very severe day. It's a day where things will go horribly wrong for the wrongdoers. And having said that, if we look at the Day of Judgment from the Quran perspective and from the hadith, the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhum salam, they say like it's going to be an extremely hot day to the extent that the sun, it is almost on top of the head of a person. Imagine that immense heat that a person would start to sweat and 40 camels will be able to drink and be fulfilled from his sweat. That's how severe it is. And then we have a hadith that says, on that day, there are people who are covered, meaning they have a shade. They are under the shade of the throne of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Amongst those people are the ones who are good to their parents. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says in a hadith, Musa ibn Imran, the Prophet salawatullahi alayhi, he said, Kana yunaji rabbah. He was talking to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He looked up and he saw a person under the shade of the throne of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Who is this person who has been shaded by your throne? Which is, you know, a great thing to be under the throne of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This person had two good traits. One, he was nice and kind to his parents. Two, وَلَمْ يَمْشِ بِالنَّمِيمَةِ. He did not go around trying to create problems between people and gossiping between them. These two traits will ensure that me and you, we will be shaded under the shade of the throne of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Also, the alayhim as-salam, when they talk about being nice to the parents, they consider it to be a sign of Shi'ism. So Shia themselves, they have specific characteristics, they have specific traits they need to have. And we can differentiate them based on these traits. One of the traits of the Shia, the followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam, is being kind to your parents. Imam Sadiq alayhi as-salam, he says in a hadith, by Allah, our Shia are not anyone but those that I will mention. So he begins with Taqallah, and then he goes to Walbirri bilwalidain, when they are nice and kind to the parents. So if you have a person who is, let's say, rude to his parents, yells at them, speaks harsh with them, argues with them, makes them upset, then differently he should put a cross on himself when it comes to classifying himself as a Shia of the Ahlul Bayt. Inshallah, we will leave it here and we will continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
A new study says a major system of ocean currents that ferries heat from the tropics to the North Atlantic could shut down far sooner than expected. Such a collapse would prove catastrophic for Earth's climate. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to WEON, an ocean current system responsible for transporting heat from the tropics to the North Atlantic may shut down much earlier than previously thought, with potentially catastrophic consequences for Earth's climate. Recent predictions indicate that an ocean current system known as the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, has been weakening as the Earth continues to warm up. Despite this, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, had previously stated that the complete shutdown of the AMOC was not expected to happen within this century. But a new study by a group of researchers from Niels Bohr Institute at the University of Copenhagen has challenged the notion, suggesting that the AMOC could halt as early as 2025. Findings were published on Tuesday, July 25th, in the journal Nature Communications. Using advanced statistical tools and ocean temperature data from the last 150 years, the researchers calculated that the ocean current known as the Thermohaline Circulation, or the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, AMOC, will collapse with 95% certainty between 2025 and 2095, the study said. The most probable time for this collapse is estimated to be around 2057. Though some climate scientists urge caution, pointing to the uncertainties in the data that could affect accuracy, the mere possibility of the AMOC shutting down so soon remains deeply concerning. The AMOC, which includes the Gulf Stream, plays a crucial role in carrying heat away from the tropics. Without it, the tropics would experience rapid temperature increases and disruption of vital tropical rains, with severe impacts on the environments of regions such as South America, Western Africa, India, and other parts of South Asia. Shutting down the AMOC can have very serious consequences for Earth's climate, for example, by changing heat wave and precipitation are disturbed globally. While a cooling of Europe may seem less severe as the globe as a whole becomes warmer and heat waves occur more frequently,
This shutdown will contribute to an increased warming of the tropics, where rising temperatures have already given rise to challenging living conditions, Professor Peter Ditlevsen from the Niels Bohr Institute said in an official statement. Furthermore, northern and western Europe would lose its supply of warm water from the tropics, leading to increased storms and extremely cold winters in those areas. The absence of the Gulf Stream would also result in rising sea levels along the eastern seaboard of the United States. The website of Earth Sky also noted, we don't often see a scientific paper that uses the word warning in its title, but a new paper published on July 25, 2023 in the prestigious journal Nature does use that word. It describes an imminent collapse of a key system of ocean currents due to global warming. The paper is titled Warning of a Forthcoming Collapse of the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. And this paper says the collapse could come as early as 2025. The ocean currents of the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, as known as AMOC, help transport heat around the globe, so they are a key factor in a wide variety of weather and climate conditions. A collapse of this system of currents could cause a precipitous drop in temperatures in Europe, including Scandinavia. It could raise sea level on the U.S. East Coast, and it could disrupt rainfall that billions of people depend on for food in India, South America, and West Africa. The new calculations come from scientists at the University of Copenhagen. Peter Ditlevsen of the university's Niels Bohr Institute led the study and told The Guardian, I think we should be very worried. This would be a very, very large change. The AMOC has not been shut off for 12,000 years. The shutdown could come as early as 2025, the scientists found, or as late as 2095, with the greatest probability occurring around the year 2057, if current greenhouse gas emissions persist. These new results contradict the latest report from the IPCC, which suggested the AMOC would not shut down until sometime in the 22nd century. As always, not everyone agrees on the exact timing, but there has been evidence prior to this that the currents in the AMOC system are vulnerable to climate change, and there is widespread acknowledgement that a change in these currents would change Earth's weather. David Thornalley at University College London told The Guardian that the study had large caveats and unknowns. He said further research was essential, but he said, if the statistics are robust and a relevant way to describe how the actual AMOC behaves, then this is a very concerning result. The researchers' prediction relies on observations of what they called early warning signals that ocean currents exhibit as they become unstable. These early warning signals for the thermohaline circulation had been reported previously. However, according to these scientists, it's only now become possible to predict when a collapse will occur. thanks to the development of advanced statistical methods. Susan Ditlevsen of the University of Copenhagen's Department of Math Sciences, the new study's co-author, said, "Using new and improved statistical tools, we've made calculations that provide a more robust estimate of when a collapse of the AMOC is most likely to occur. This is something we had not been able to do before." They said the thermohaulin circulation has operated in its present mode since the last iceberg, which ended approximately 11,000 years ago. During that ice age, the circulation of these ocean currents did indeed collapse. Abrupt climate jumps between the present state of the AMOC and the collapse state has been observed to happen 25 times in connection with ice age climate. These are the famous Dansgaard-Oseager events, first observed in ice cores from the Greenlandic ice sheet. At those events, climate changes were extreme with 10 to 15 degrees Celsius changes over a decade. Meanwhile, the present day's climate change is 1.5 degrees Celsius, warming over a century.
Yani
Bazaar
The construction industry has continuously had a series of revolutions throughout history. Technological advancements have influenced the construction sector too, from durable concrete in ancient structures to smart windows that automatically open and close based on light exposure. Some materials evolved with time, others are new to the industry and address natural disasters while reflecting changing lifestyles and environmental values. Still, other materials are born out of a need to reduce construction costs. In a nutshell, structures and their materials are the building blocks of society and economic expansion.
Hello everyone, Ali Reza here, welcoming you to a brand new edition of Bazaar. This week, we are taking you on a journey through Iran's mammoth building construction industry while highlighting some of the country's recent developments in this sector. Plus, we will check out its market as a whole and the construction industry's contributions to the national economy. So, let's get started. To understand the enormity of the construction industry, we visited the 22nd Annual International Building and Construction Exhibition in Tehran. Because the exhibition was sprawled over nearly 4 hectares of land, one day is not nearly enough for visitors to see the entire expo, so it ran for 3 days. This exhibition is one of the most important events in its industry. We caught up with a few companies at the exhibit to see what they were offering. Our first stop was at a booth held by a company that makes ceramic tiles. They also export their products to numerous countries. Next, we stopped by a company specializing in manufacturing faucets and kitchen and bathroom attachments. It also purchases most of its raw materials from inside the country. Like many we have seen at the event, this company has created many job opportunities directly and indirectly. Plus, it uses the latest machinery to make high-quality products that compete with foreign brands. Now, many might not think twice about it, but Iran's faucet and fixture production have been booming. So we spoke with another company that has been exporting these items for years.
Industry participants say this year's Building Expo was much larger than last year's, meaning that Iran's construction industry has expanded in recent years, displaying the country's various existing and emerging capabilities in the field. Statistics show that last year some 900 domestic companies participated in the events. Also, foreign companies were present, offering their goods and services.
This year's exhibit hosted hundreds of foreign companies from Germany, Australia, Turkey, China, Spain, Italy, South Korea, and Malaysia, just to name a few. A wealth of products were showcased at the expo, from road and construction equipment to stones, sanitary supplies, heating and cooling systems, lifts and elevators, and so much more. Rarely has any industry offered so much versatility and variety of products as the construction industry. Events like this one offer a platform for the exchange of ideas, examining markets and opportunities for collaboration to create new products needed in the market. Next, we stopped by a display for a company specializing in making various inset kitchen products. We asked them about their goods and approach to challenges posed by the US sanctions. Walking through the exhibit, we ran into a company that makes metal fittings for stairs, windows, and areas that require spatial separations.
All things considered, the construction sector has been significant for the Iranian economy. The sector is divided into two main parts: government infrastructure projects and the housing industry. The construction industry has been thriving due to national and international investment to the extent that it is now one of the largest in the West Asia region.
This sector suffered a lot after the US withdrew from the 2015 deal and reimposed sanctions against Iran. These measures choked construction materials imports. As a result, the steady flow of things like metals to Iran was seriously hampered and eventually halted altogether. But despite the bans, this industry continues to grow and is also one of the few that exports services to other countries. Based on the Association of Iranian Exports of Technical and Engineering Services, Iran currently has the potential to export engineering services worth $40 billion annually. The country already exports these services to countries around the Caspian Sea, its bordering neighbors, South and Central America, North Africa, and South Asia. Some construction projects include sewage treatment plants, dams, and energy plants. According to the Ministry of Industry, Mining, and Trade, Iran is self-sufficient in construction material production. Steel, glass, and cement are abundantly produced in the country. Moreover, the surplus of these items is exported to countries worldwide. Government officials say they have plans to expand exports to Iran's trade partners, including China and Russia. For example, the Ministry of Industry, Mine and Trade says it plans to sell upwards of $3 billion worth of construction materials to Russia alone. As a whole, the government views the construction sector as a feasible alternative for generating foreign revenues and diversifying the country's economy away from oil profits.
All right, now it's time to check out this week's special feature of Bazaar. So let's see where Sarah has been this past week.
In an ever-increasing technology-driven world, city streets are becoming more and more congested than ever before, while connected and autonomous technologies in vehicles are also on the rise. Such safety concerns pose a significant challenge for city planners and traffic engineers to improve mobility, safety, and efficient use of roadways now and in the future. When you are driving to work, or especially going on a road trip, you need to be fully alert to avoid the hidden cameras all across the road from catching you or costing you a damage. Well, sometimes this can be really irritating. But have you ever thought of the significant impacts they have in the most challenging situations? Today, we decided to take you to a company active in the field of intelligent transportation system in Shadif University of Technology. Let's go check it out.